Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. From the agriculture industry to home builders and restaurants, climate change is impacting the way business is being done across the Sacramento and Central Valleys. Those who can adapt, innovate, and have the means to do so may find themselves better able to take on the challenges, while others who wait may struggle to survive in this new reality we're finding ourselves trying to navigate. Our ag industry is a big one here and has been dealing with years of drought, extreme weather, and of course, devastating wildfires. Farmers are trying to stay ahead of a rapidly changing landscape. We are joined by Adam Steinhauer, editor-at-large at the Sacramento Business Journal, and reporter Emily Hammond. The Biz Journal just produced a series of reports on how climate change is already or will soon impact how business is being conducted in our area. Welcome both. Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Adam, let's start with you. Explain how and why y'all decided to tackle this topic. How did you choose the topics you reported on?
Yeah, basically, I mean, it's just a constant theme in talking about business and the economy in the region these days. It's a great deal of expense in terms of complying with the regulation. And it's a great deal of expense in terms of adjusting, in terms of the potential changes to ag in particular, in terms of what the crop mix is likely to look like in the future, and in terms of adjusting to the lack of water in years such as this one. It's a great deal of adjustment for the construction and development industries in terms of making buildings more sustainable. And it's going to be a great deal of adjustment in terms of how they plan the region in the future.
Yeah, there are a lot of interests and industries that are essential but can also compete with each other. When talking about this, what struck you about the reporting that you all did?
Basically, just what an overarching issue it is in terms of both the expense and the adjustment it's going to require of just about every industry. And also a lot of opportunity. Sacramento is a region that's, I think, is particularly might be focused more than others on solving this in terms of a lot of the research that comes out of UC Davis. Larger companies here, such as Origin Materials, focused on creating plastics without petroleum products, things like the California Mobility Center in town, trying to develop new technology for mobility that's more sustainable. So there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of adjustment for everybody. And it's kind of an underlying theme just about everywhere you look if you scratch the surface.
Yeah, which led to a handful of articles and reporting from the Biz Journal. So, Emily, let's start with you and drill down on your story, because you focused on the impact of climate change on the Sacramento area's ag industry. How big of a threat does climate change pose for the farming and ranching industry in our area?
Climate change poses a pretty significant threat. California's climate is one of the factors that makes our, of course, massive and flourishing agricultural industry economically viable in the first place. So the climate here, the warm Mediterranean climate, is kind of what helps farmers grow fresh fruits, vegetables, nuts, those kinds of things that fetch higher prices and make farming in the kind of more higher cost environment of California more economically viable in the first place. And so, of course, any small change to that climate poses a threat of kind of a massive disruption to the industry.
Yeah, and given that our state is now in our third year of drought-like restrictions, which impacts water, and water is essential, and it's becoming more scarce and more expensive, in your reporting, you say that just last year alone, our area's agricultural losses were over $400 million. How did that come about? And comparatively, if you can help us visualize, how big of a deal is $400 million to the ag industry in California?
That is a pretty significant deal. And so the most of the losses that we saw in the last year due to drought were was land going unplanted. I believe it was about 250,000 acres of land that just went unplanted that in previous years would have been planted with crops. And of course, there's not enough water at the beginning of the year. Farmers just decide they're not going to plant anything at all. And those economic losses are huge. They're especially felt in the rural areas in California that are really the lifeblood. Agriculture is the lifeblood of those small communities who depend on that money coming in to not only pay the farmers, of course, but pay all the employees in the town, feed those families, that kind of thing. And so it doesn't impact, you know, of course, everyone equally, but it is a significant impact on certain parts of our California economy.
Which sectors of the agricultural industry are being impacted more by drought?
Currently, a lot of that large impact that we saw in the Sacramento Valley last year was due to rice. It was more than 200,000 acres of rice, which is a massive crop in Sacramento Valley and here in Yolo, Colusa counties, that kind of thing. And yeah, more than 200,000 acres, farmers just did not have the water to plant rice. And so they didn't. And so that was left empty when it could have been, an economic generator for those communities.
Yeah. What I learned from your reporting, often when we think of these heat waves, we think of the highs, you know, these triple digit temperatures. But also what's really crucial are the overnight lows. And those have been changing as well, which is impacting these industries and crops.
Yeah, that's actually something that I was surprised to discover, too, is actually one of the things that is probably the most pressing, the most immediate impact we'll see on the horizon is due to these, not just, of course, the extreme high temperatures, but actually the loss of cold temperatures in the winter. These tree crops need a certain amount. They need to, our researchers call it chill hours. So in the winter, they need to accumulate a certain amount of hours where the trees sit at lower temperatures. And if they don't get that lower temperatures, if they don't accumulate enough chill hours, it actually is really detrimental to the blossoming cycle, which of course harms the yield for the entire plant. And by the end of the 21st century, researchers are thinking that the number of chill hours in the Sacramento Valley could be cut in half, which of course will have a dramatic impact on what kind of crops will grow here at all.
Often when having these conversations, there's the argument that since the climate is changing in California, why not switch crops to crops that are more sustainable? What are the challenges to achieving that?
There are, some challenges. Of course, that is going to be ultimately one of the ways that the industry is able to ride kind of this climate change that's coming. But the industry in general, it must be slow to adapt. Kind of over the past decades, we've seen an increase in orchard crops, these perennial crops, things like almonds, of course, we've seen go in, cherries, wine grapes. These are all crops that have massive returns, but they also require a huge upfront investment, and they're intended to last for sometimes decades at a time. Those growers kind of putting in those tree crops, if they want to make the most out of their investment, they really need to start thinking now about what exactly they're going to plant.
Right. And they're putting that investment largely on the front end, hoping that this will last for years or even decades, correct?
Exactly. It is a massive, unlike, you know, the annual crops, which you plant every year and then get returns every year. These tree crops require a huge upfront investment. And then growers hope they can make their money back kind of over a course of sometimes decades, 20 years or more in the case of some plants.
So given all of that, how are growers starting to change the way they plan in order to adapt to these drier years?
Yes, that is kind of the good news is that what I heard, the bottom line is that a lot of these impacts can be mitigated if the industry is willing to adapt. One of the things that's already happening, of course, over the past few decades, the almond industry, for example, has really worked hard to reduce its water use through things like more precision irrigation. Things like that. And then also crop breeding is a huge potential for the impact, for reducing this impact that we could see from climate change. Of course, we have a renowned crop science program here at UC Davis, and researchers are working on developing new varietals of crops that require less water, take less fertilizer, are more insect resistant, and need fewer of those chill hours every winter, like we talked about earlier.
Yeah. Even though that's promising, I mean, the challenges are layered. It's not only climate change or extreme weather and wildfires, but growers in California are still struggling with all the other economic pressures of the past few years. I mean, can you talk to us about how our local industry is faring today when we're talking about or take into account supply chain issues, inflation, et cetera?
Of course. Yeah, this year, a lot of the growers I spoke to, climate change is kind of the last thing on their mind. Most of what they're dealing with now is Like all of us, inflation, their costs of inputs, you know, fertilizer, pesticides, that kind of thing has skyrocketed over just this past year. And meanwhile, they're dealing with, for those growers who export their crop, like a lot of them do, like rice, almonds, they are dealing with this massive supply chain disruption at our ports. They're unable to export large portions of their crop. They're not getting paid for it. And so the costs of farming this year, the cost of water also has exploded. So costs are extremely high this year with much lower returns, which is a negative situation overall for the farmers.
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about how climate change is already impacting several industries here in the Sacramento area and Central Valley. All right, Adam, you are the editor at large at the Sacramento Business Journal, and your team focus on other topics related to climate change and our local economy. So let's move to the restaurant industry, because it's gearing up for some major changes when it comes to the use of gas energy, essentially scaling it down. What's exactly happening?
Yeah, the city of Sacramento has adopted an ordinance that will require new construction starting next year for buildings under four stories high to be all electric. This is an issue for the restaurant industry in that there are a lot of chefs who are accustomed to cooking on gas grills, particularly some ethnic cuisines. Most chefs use gas grills. Electric cooking equipment that achieves similar effects is not generally available. Now, there was an original talk about requiring this of existing buildings. That's postponed. So restaurants already in existence have some adjustment period before anything like that, although the city of Sacramento is considering an ordinance in the future for existing building. Now, city officials we spoke to emphasized to us that they hope to implement this in an equitable way, in a way that allows restaurant operators to apply for waivers if switching to an all-electric system isn't feasible. But for now, starting next year, new construction, including restaurant buildings, are expected to be all-electric. And I believe in 2026, taller buildings over three stories will have the same requirement.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of Sacramento, in my opinion, is the variety of food and ethnic cuisines. When you talk to those restaurant owners, many of them small restaurant owners, what do they have to say about this?
They express concern. I mean, again, it's not something that is going to immediately take effect for restaurants that are already in existence. But industry representatives we spoke to expressed concern that this is going to be an incentive against opening new restaurants that rely on gas cooking, and new Asian restaurants in particular. Those who are already operating are concerned about what's coming in the future in terms of this being implemented for existing buildings.
And having to spend more money to transition to that, correct?
Having to spend more money to transition, and even if it's feasible to transition to it. There doesn't seem to be, from what we can tell talking to folks, a widely known and available replacement for gas cooking for a wok grill. And maybe the technology is in development, but it doesn't seem to be available or affordable for the average restaurateur.
When it comes to the variety of, you know, energy sources that we have, by relying heavily on electricity, can utility providers shoulder this? I mean, having alternative sources would allow businesses, restaurants in this case, navigate potential outages.
It's a concern. And I should say, another story we included in this package is one about the new rules for all commercial construction to include some solar and energy storage. You know, basically, all commercial buildings under state regulations are going to be required to have some sustainable power source, such as solar. And there is a broader concern in the construction industry and the development industry that the utility system isn't ready for it. And we've had the rolling blackouts in recent years, and there's concern that that will happen again. Yeah, there is definitely a concern that the power industry in California is not ready for this. There's a lot of focus on energy storage, basically, to have buildings ready to continue powering if the grid goes down. Basically, a way to deal with the unevenness of solar power in terms of power availability during the day and not during the evening. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move to the new regulations about solar. This is a continuation that was already implemented into home construction, right?
Correct. And it's generally the feeling was in the industry that the requirement for new home construction went pretty smoothly. So starting next year, it's going to be required also for commercial construction. So it is not yet required that all buildings are self-sustaining in terms of power, but they are going to all be required to have some solar and storage and some of that. There are questions still about, you know, when they're going to be self-sustaining. There are questions about what are going to be done for smaller buildings that, you know, frankly, don't have the room on the rooftop for enough solar panels to be self-sustaining. A lot of this is likely to be done through kind of off-site solar farms that basically building owners are going to be able to buy from, basically, and there'll be those sorts of requirements. But this is also coming against the background, again, of the power industry possibly not being ready. It's also amidst a lot of uncertainty in building and construction in general. And in terms of the office market, there's a lot of adjustment going on, at least not knowing how much any of us are going to be back in the office permanently, and office owners are adjusting to that. Nobody really quite knows how much office space they're going to need. There's a lot of adjustment happening in the retail industry with more shopping online, and that affects retail real estate also. So this is one more thing for folks in that industry to navigate.
When talking about building, how ultimately could this impact cost and affordability, since we already have maybe some lessons learned from home construction?
Yeah, tough to say. I mean, builders we spoke to, of course, emphasized that it's a new expense, and there is a general feeling that, you know, in the industry that they have not really been included in these decisions. And yeah, it's an expense going forward, and it will affect affordability. But again, that's also on the other side of that. Demand is uncertain, so maybe that will hold down costs in terms of demand. But yeah, that is a concern.
Lastly, there is a road between El Dorado Hills and Elk Grove called the Capital Southeast Connector, which is in the works. And there's a tax measure on the November ballot, which will fund this. If this is new to people, can you explain what the Capital Southeast Connector is hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, it's basically a new highway under construction that would basically go around the central city from Elk Grove to El Dorado Hills. Proponents basically say this is necessary just with the region's growth. Just it's needed in terms of new transportation infrastructure. Opponents in the environmental activist community and also the Sacramento area Council of Governments has done an analysis that raises concerns that basically a new highway between those two cities out in the suburbs will encourage urban sprawl. Make it more difficult for the Sacramento region to achieve its goals in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And aside from the negative with that, could also make it harder for the region in the future to qualify for state funding for transportation if we're not in compliance with the state's goals for greenhouse gas emissions.
Is this connector going to move forward regardless if this moves forward on the November ballot?
Uncertain. It's something they have been working on for a while and are still working to get funding for, but this is a big piece of funding. This particular ballot measure includes funding for a lot of transportation needs other than the Southeast Area Connector. Interestingly, there was a similar ballot measure in the last election and other times recently that was largely supported by many of the same groups who are concerned about it now. But this the measure this time is being funded, as we understand it, by development interests and construction interests who want to see that that freeway built in terms of it being able to support development in the southeast area of the county.
Before I let you both go, just taking in your series of reporting, I'm struck by the competing interests and the challenge of striking the right balance. What is encouraging about the Sacramento and Central Valleys in terms of being positioned to weather these economic consequences of climate change? Adam, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think what's encouraging, and we didn't really get into this series, but we have in general, is there are a lot of ventures starting here that are aimed at tackling this challenge. There's a lot of startups in this region focused on climate and on sustainability. There's a lot of research out of UC Davis and companies that have spun out of UC Davis focused on making agriculture more sustainable and manufacturing more sustainable. SMUD is considered a leader in the utility industry in terms of providing sustainable power. So why it's a risk and a cost to a lot of people in business. On the flip side of it, there's a lot of money and ingenuity going towards solving that problem and helping meet the challenge. And that will create jobs, will create wealth, and maybe make the consequences of climate change less dire than it might otherwise be.
Emily, where did you find some promise in your reporting?
Yeah, just to echo what Adam said, I think the innovation just flourishing in the region. Of course, UC Davis in agriculture specifically is, of course, the worldwide kind of juggernaut that it is in crop science, and they're located right here. You know, growers here ready to try new ideas, ready to adapt to change, ready to innovate. I think from what I reported on, the people I talked to, they say these challenges basically are daunting, but if anyone was to solve them, it would be right here in the Sacramento region.
Emily and Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you
very much.
Adam Steinhauer is editor-at-large at the Sacramento Business Journal, and reporter Emily Hammond covering the agriculture industry for the Biz Journal. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The 911 for mental health officially went live across the country this weekend. 988 is a new hotline that routes callers to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. People can call, text, or chat and be connected with trained counselors to connect them to resources and support. But this simply isn't a light switch, however years in the making. And a transition of this magnitude also comes with funding and staffing challenges for the long term. So we're going to learn about California's rollout of 988. Dr. Leandra Clark Harvey is the CEO of California Council of Community Behavioral Health Agencies, which represents four of the state's 13 call centers. Tara Gamboa Eastman is with the Steinberg Institute. The nonprofit was founded by Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, which focuses on public policy surrounding issues of brain health. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Dr. Clark Harvey, starting with you, I mean, we're about 2 days into this. How did the weekend go?
Wow, what an exciting weekend. We were just anticipating this and so very, very excited to hit the ground running. The call centers have been gearing up for this. And so we're just watching this closely and looking forward to how they handle the calls, but have really great confidence in their ability. They've been doing this for decades.
Who should call 988?
Anyone in crisis, they have a need that would not traditionally be answered by 911. So a need that has any type of mental health crisis, stress, trauma response that they feel is needed. This is why we have to have a robust system, of course, so that the right people get to the right people to get the mental health assistance that they need in time of crisis.
You mentioned that the people who are going to be taking these calls have been doing this for years, so there's existing infrastructure to this. But walk us through what happens when someone calls 988.
When someone calls 988, calls are answered 90% of the time. You're going to get a call answered within a few minutes. People are going to be directed to a trained individual who is able to assist them in time of crisis. This is their expertise. So they're calling into somebody that's able to deal with a variety of mental health issues And thankfully, our call centers have already shown that they're able to ameliorate 90% of the calls that come in. Only 2 to 3 have to be referred outside of the call center to get extra help, or maybe the help of someone, deployment of someone in law enforcement. They've been very, very successful at this.
What is the California Council of Community Behavioral Health and Agencies, which you lead? What is the role? What is your role in the state's rollout?
Well, 4 of our members, we represent community-based organizations that provide mental health and substance abuse services across the state. And 4 of our agencies we represent actually run call centers. So in addition to the, oh my goodness, grueling day in and day out work that they're doing in the midst of this pandemic, they're also running these centers. So we represent their interests, and we've been honored to work with the Steinberg Institute and Kennedy Forum in supporting a number of budget and legislative proposals to help the call centers ramp up for the line that just turned on this weekend.
Yeah, so you're talking about 4, but there are a total of 13 call centers in California that are going to be receiving these 988 calls. How effective are these call centers in resolving crisis?
They're incredibly effective. There are 13 centers, as you mentioned, and we know that even with the pandemic, that we saw numbers skyrocket. One call center said they had upwards of 60% plus calls, but they were still able to handle it. And it's because they have expertise here. They're incredibly effective. They've been answering calls successfully for 90% of calls that come into California. They also answer some calls that come out from other states. And this is because California call centers have demonstrated effectiveness for many, many years. So we kind of lead the way in many ways in terms of our part of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and the help that they're able to provide consumers that call in.
Tara, moving to you, what is the Steinberg Institute's role in California's rollout of this new 988 hotline?
We've been thrilled to co-sponsor, along with the Kennedy Forum, a number of organizations, and with the support of many, like Dr. Clark Harvey's organization, the legislation to implement the 988 system. We're co-sponsoring AB 988, which would set up the long-term planning process for the rest of the crisis continuum that will connect to 988, as well as a permanent funding source to make sure that the system is always funded and there is always someone to answer the phone.
In your view, what struck you about this weekend?
It was such a monumental moment that has been building for decades and for years. The call centers have been doing this since 2004 and decades before that. And really, I think what you're seeing is the country coalescing around a health response to a health crisis. And we're seeing dollars be implemented, the call centers coming together to do this wonderful work. And in the legislature, the bill is picking up momentum with unanimous votes in its most recent committee. And so it's really just exciting to see it all starting to come together, even though it's just the beginning of the work.
Yeah, we'll get to that bill in just a moment. Dr. Clark Harvey, this was announced in 2020. So this is a couple years in the making under then President Trump, which meant there were problems already in responding to mental health calls, which I don't think is a surprise, but leading to 888 as a hopeful solution. What were those main challenges in compassionately and effectively responding to mental health calls?
Though the crisis centers here in California have been able to successfully answer the call for those in need, I think some of the challenges is just that suicide rates are skyrocketing and they continue to, with the pandemic layered on top of it. Crises and other mental health problems continue to be a problem. And you can see that in how our state and our governor has responded and really prioritized funding for mental health and substance use disorders. We know we have an opioid issue across the nation. And so the call centers were already very busy in answering the need for what's happening across the nation in terms of our mental health and substance use disorder service system. Now we're working together to make sure that we invest in them. And we're so grateful to the administration for the investment that will enable the call centers to continue to be geared up and continue to provide good crisis service.
Tara, this is an alternative to 911. How will this be different than 911, and why is 911 unsustainable?
I think one of the key differences between 988 and 911 is that with 988, The call is the intervention. Like Dr. Clark Harvey said, these call centers are able to address upwards of 98% of these calls over the phone and no in-person response is needed. So that is a massive difference from 911 operators who are just picking up the phone and triaging to get folks out into the field. The work that remains ahead is to change the full crisis continuum from who you're calling to who's coming to respond and where you're going. And so the first part that launched this Saturday was who's answering the phone. We now have the three-digit number directly linked to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. What we're trying to do here in California via legislation is link 988 to mobile crisis teams staffed by trained mental health professionals who can respond as an alternative to law enforcement, as well as set up connections to crisis receiving and stabilization centers so people don't end up languishing in our emergency rooms and jails.
Okay, so I want to get into that because this currently will look differently from one county to the next. There's 13 call centers, 58 counties. So what are kind of maybe like the polar opposites in terms of when someone calls 988, will one receive a mental health crisis team in one area or law enforcement in another when talking about the disparity in resources?
Right now, all 13 call centers have and continue to have a connection to 911 to transfer calls that require an in-person intervention. In a medical crisis, such as an overdose, that might be a paramedic. In other counties, and depending on the situations, it could be one of those mobile crisis teams, or it could be law enforcement. It is going to vary right now, depending on county resources and what is available there, as well as the circumstances of the situation. What's really important about 988 is the promise and potential to make sure that folks always get the appropriate response that they need. And in most cases, that's going to be mobile crisis teams staffed by trained mental health professionals. And again, that's why we're working so hard to get AB 988 passed so that we have uniform standards across the counties and uniform connections. So someone in Fresno is getting the same response as someone in Alameda.
But until then, that can make some people feel uncomfortable, especially in areas where law enforcement will respond and some communities who have strained trust with law enforcement, such as communities of color, LGBTQ plus communities. How will 988 handle that responsibly and delicately?
Absolutely. Again, nothing has changed in the protocols with the switch from the 1-800 to 988. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is going to continue to operate as it always has, with most of those calls being resolved over the phone. If someone is in immediate danger, or there's a mandated reporting issue, first responders may be connected, but the goal is always to de-escalate over the phone whenever possible and to use the least invasive resources possible. And Dr. Clark Harvey's clients and members and all of the call centers are so wonderfully adept at doing this work.
When it comes to that extreme case, could a response, or is there a scenario where this could be involuntary when someone is at risk of endangering themselves or others?
It is possible that there could be an involuntary intervention, but again, the call centers are always going for that voluntary de-escalation over the phone. Voluntary services always work better, and the call centers, the counselors, and those first responders in the field do seek to do that whenever possible.
Dr. Clark Harvey, what training goes into this?
The call centers each have their own standard set of training that they provide their volunteers and staff. One of the things that we worked hard on this year with the supplement of a Molina Cares grant was to provide some standardized, a platform for standardized training for the call centers. So we wanted them all to be connected as we ramped up for 988 so that they could tap into one system and share best practices and models, et cetera. As I've mentioned, there's a lot of volunteers at the call centers. That's why this investment through the budget has been so critical in order to get people trained in a standard way, to get them ready, and to attract more people to jobs at the call center. And we know this isn't a unique situation. Workforce has been a problem, particularly within the behavioral health field for decades and continues to be with the exacerbation of the pandemic. The call centers are also struggling there too. But I always say the call centers have a kind of a do whatever it takes mentality to maintaining quality. And that's why they're able to ameliorate 98% of the calls, texts, and chats that come into them.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the national rollout of 988, the new hotline for mental health crisis calls. So we're talking about a system, 13 call centers that are heavily staffed by volunteers. There are also some funding challenges nationally. A RAND Corporation survey, and RAND is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization, found that fewer than half of public health officials nationally expressed confidence that their jurisdiction was prepared in terms of financing, staffing, or infrastructure. I'm curious what that looks like in California, Dr. Clark Harvey.
I don't have the exact figures on what the financing of the infrastructure is. Maybe Tara does, I'm not sure. But typically the call centers have received state funds to help support them, around a little under $5 million to run the call centers, which is not very much. That's why it was so important for our advocacy to continue to bolster them as we move into 988 being released.
Last fall, a CalMatters article laid out those challenges in funding for 988 in California, and they reported that you called it a dire situation and that call centers had already seen a 67% increase in volume in recent years, and that was last fall. 10 months later, what's changed?
Well, what's changed is that our administration, through the governor's office, has invested in and bolstering the call centers for the release, the turn on of the number that just happened. That has been very helpful. We went from estimating we may have needed, I don't know, $20 to $40 million immediately. We were able to receive $20 million, which we're grateful for. And then we, this year, when we reevaluated, we looked at the need, which landed around another $8 million, which thankfully, our partners at the Steinberg Institute and Kennedy Forum joined us in advocating for, and other organizations as well. So $28 million has gone into ramping up. Really, really proud of that.
Tara, how does California compare to other states?
We continue to be a leader in mental health, and specifically on 988. We're one of less than 10 states that put in those startup funds that Dr. Clark Harvey was referencing. The call centers have all of the money they estimated needing to meet the expanded call volume, and that includes getting additional staff, training, and technology. The state has invested ongoing funds for critical connections between the 988 and 911 system, but there is much work ahead, both in terms of the planning and funding of the 988 system. Assembly Bill 988 would provide ongoing annual funding to the 988 system via a small telephone fee authorized by federal legislation. It would be pennies on the dollar, just 8 cents per line per month for the first 2 years, and a lifetime cap of 30 cents, which would sustainably fund the call centers as well as those mobile crisis teams.
AB 988 was introduced last year. Why is it still a piece of legislation? What kind of opposition has there been?
As you can imagine, while we are building off of existing systems, we are integrating disparate systems that have not historically been working together and really building quite a bit of infrastructure on top of that. And it was quite an on-ramp before July 16th, and we felt it was most important to make sure that the call centers were prepared to answer the phone and take a longer time horizon in making sure the system was properly set up with stakeholder feedback over time. We have received some opposition from the telecommunications industry. I'm happy to share that they've removed their opposition to the fee, and we've seen that make quite a difference. The bill did stall last year, and we just had two committee votes with unanimous votes, bipartisan, with every member who had a chance to vote on it voting in support.
In the last minute or so that we have, I want to ask the both of you, how do you hope 988 changes society's view of mental health and someone going through a mental health crisis? Tara?
I hope that we finally start to see mental health as a health issue and folks feel just as comfortable calling and seeking help when they have a mental health crisis as if they were having a heart attack or a stroke or something else where they might call 911. I think part of the reason, aside from opposition coming off of the bill, that the bill is getting such unanimous support is because we are seeing stigma fall, because people are sharing their stories. There is no one we haven't spoken to who hasn't been personally touched or knows someone who could have benefited from 988. And we hope to continue to see that stigma fall away.
Dr. Clark Harvey, how do you hope this changes society's view of mental health?
Oh, I'd have to agree 100% with the comments just made. It's really important to decrease that stigma, particularly when we're looking at disenfranchised communities, BIPOC communities, Black, Indigenous, people of color, those who have traditionally strayed away from engaging with the mental health and substance use disorder system because of cultural beliefs. And so with this number getting more attention, the hope is that access is increased and that stigma is definitely decreased for everyone.
I want to thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Leandra Clark Harvey is the CEO of California Council of Community Behavioral Health Agencies, which represents four of the state's 13 call centers. And Tara Gamboa Eastman is with the Steinberg Institute. The nonprofit focuses on public policy surrounding issues of brain health. They're discussing the national rollout of dialing 988, a new hotline for mental health calls. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. What is history for one is a valuable collector's item for another. This week, the nation's largest political memorabilia convention embarks on Reno, which means hundreds of collectors converge with thousands of political buttons, campaign posters, pop culture, and other historical items in tow. The annual event is hosted by the American Political Items Convention, or APIC, for short. Adam Gottlieb is with the American Political Items Convention and joins us with a lay of the land to the National Convention in Reno. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Vicky. And we are just fired up and ready to go.
I can imagine. Well, let's start off with a little bit of your background first. When did you become passionate about political memorabilia?
Well, you know, there is an origin story. When I was in the fourth grade, growing up in New York, we took a field trip to Teddy Roosevelt's summer home in Oyster Bay. And when I got to see all of the ephemera, all of the items that Teddy Roosevelt amassed in his lifetime, his short lifetime, I might add, big game hunter, president, conservationist, vice president, governor, and don't forget, he was a father. And, you know, all of these things, I was just, okay, I had an exciting, passionate following for TR. Mm-hmm. And my passion led to reading many books about Teddy Roosevelt. And my father came back from an estate sale one day with a photograph of TR on a naval ship. And well, we were off to the races. So since then, I've been a member of the American Political Items Collector since I was 10 years old. I am a passionate armchair historian, and this show is going to be amazing.
Yeah, you are now co-chair of the National Convention. And how do you explain this convention to someone who didn't even know that political memorabilia of this magnitude existed in such an organized and communal fashion? Is there a common thread between you all collectors?
Well, yes. Actually, people who are collectors are passionate about saving history, preserving history, and also using history to tell the story. The American Political Items Collectors has had 30 national conventions before this one. First time in Reno, this time at the Atlantis. But people who are collectors want to find a tangible way to tell the story. The story of the United States can be told with buttons and with automobile attachments and ribbons and posters and photographs, whether it's the moon landing or Watergate or civil rights or women getting the right to vote or the assassination of Harvey Milk or JFK beating Nixon in 1960 or Vietnam and LBJ. And don't forget FDR and Fireside Chat. So the radio ties in also, but people who are collectors range from students to stockbrokers. And what we have here is a very special opportunity to see America laid out in tangible buttons and banners.
Given that you've been a member since you were 10 years old, what are the holy grail memorable moments in past years and decades?
Oh, good heavens. Like I said, I've been a collector for a long time, and people who come into the show for the very first time, it's so exciting to see their eyes pop, especially kids. The show at the Atlantis on Friday and Saturday is free to everybody. We have exhibits. We even offer free appraisal. So go into the closet of that dusty garage and see what you got. You might be sitting on treasure, but the thing that I love is that somebody comes into a show with something they don't know what its value is. And they, in one case, there was a woman who needed to make rent and she was really hard up, and she had a cigar box of her grandfather's buttons from 1924. They were matched perfectly, all the different sizes. Buttons from 1924 were really hard to come by from the Democratic Party. She walked out of the convention with $14,000 and she was crying. She wanted it to go back to the hobby. And when the button comes back into the hobby, when I say the hobby, I mean the collectors, mm-hmm. It is a passion. It is a way to tell America's story through these little ephemeral items. Nobody thought to save a newspaper from the Chicago Tribune, but when Harry Truman held up the paper that said Dewey beats Truman, that's a collectible.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredible. I mean, mementos that on the surface seem like the equivalent of a few coins, but upon further inspection and an appraisal were worth exponentially more. What do you classify as political memorabilia or even pop culture items?
Thanks for asking. The people who come to the show will be surprised because it's not just I Like Ike, which, by the way, single best marketing slogan ever. The idea is to promote a candidate. So when Teddy Roosevelt coined the phrase, "My hat is in the ring," you'll see a button that says, "My hat is in the ring." Somebody might not know that's political. They might see a button that's got Elvis on it or the Beatles. That is, of course, pop culture. Pop culture could be a suffragette a sash that was worn in 1920 when women got the right to vote. Pop culture could be something from the farm labor movement or the civil rights movement. When Martin Luther King spoke on the March on Washington, he was wearing a button that had two hands clasping in friendship. That, of course, is not, well, one can make the argument it is political, but it is also pop culture. The Batman fan club, if you want to get a little more, you know, kooky. Morris the Cat for president, you know, all of the non-people who ran for president, you'll find that here and more.
I mean, you let off with Teddy Roosevelt, who was obviously a president, but are losers less valuable or collectible?
Ooh, good question. Some of the best losers are very collectible. In 1920, Ohio Governor James Cox ran with a very young Franklin Delano Roosevelt as vice president. 1920, the Democratic Party didn't have a lot of resources, and the buttons they put out were limited. Buttons are based on condition and scarcity and demand. So a button from 1920 with Cox and Roosevelt on it, if you have it, can be worth quite a fortune. One just sold at auction for over $180,000.
Oh my gosh, wow. That's definitely worth the drive to Reno for sure.
Worth the drive to Reno. But let me be clear. You can get into the hobby for a dollar. You can pick up a button that says LSD, not LBJ. you can pick up a button that says, you know, gimme Jimmy and the rise of Carter. I mean, think about it. The nation was reeling from Watergate, and Jimmy Carter came in as the governor of Georgia, and his iconic teeth sort of echoed back to Teddy Roosevelt's teeth in 1904, 1912. And you didn't even need to see the candidate's name on the button. All you saw was the teeth, and you knew who you were voting for.
Yeah, you're hitting on a very important theme. I think it's good to end with this. I mean, beyond the value is really an appreciation for American history. Why is it important to preserve the past in this way?
Well, let's be clear. It's a fun hobby, and people who are passionate about history, we'll see this all at the Atlantis Casino Thursday and Friday. APIC.us, of course, is our website. But the thing that I love about history is that it comes alive. You can pick up a PT boat, a little tie clasp that says PT-109, and know that JFK was using his veteran status to garner votes. The reason why it's important to follow history is it's much more engaging than a dusty history book. You get excited about it. The fact of following this really is, it's my hobby. I love history.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Adam Gottlieb is with the American Political Items Convention. They are having a national convention in Reno Friday and Saturday. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.